Hello and welcome to Mintcast, a podcast by the Linux Mint community for all users of Linux. This is episode 219, recorded live on Sunday, the 22nd of February, 2015. I'm Joe, and with me on the podcast this week is Rob.
Yay!
Scott's, we think, up in the air, sort of mid-Atlantic.
Yeah, rumor has it that he's left the country for some reason. I'm not sure what's going on there.
He's come specifically for the meetup on Thursday that there's no point plugging, really, because this probably won't be out in time.
Yeah, if you're listening to this not live, then they had a meetup, probably today.
Oh, well, it depends. If I do post on this, I might do it a bit more quickly than usual.
It could be done earlier. That's true. Could be done earlier. You never know about these things.
Anyway, we record live every other week on Sunday afternoons, American time, Sunday evenings, my time. Watch the Mintcast website or the Mintcast community on Google Plus for the schedule. The live stream information is available at mintcast.org/livestream, and we're in the Mintcast channel on the SpotChat IRC server, irc.spotchat.org. And I suppose the Freenode server, irc.freenode.net, but I'm never in that one.
Yeah, nobody but me and Mock Turtle are over there right now. Oh, I see Tony SMLR is there too, but I don't see much. It's crickets over on that side of the fence today.
Yeah. So the pre-show music this week was Angus Wallace, Yesterday's Conversation, and Tamara Laurel with Lightning, both available on Jamendo.
I'm liking them both.
Yeah. So it's been a couple of weeks at least. So what have you been up to, Rob?
So what have I been up to? I have been slowly accumulating gear for the new Raspberry Pi, which was supposed to have been delivered by the fine U.S. Postal Service yesterday, but which didn't arrive. So I'm still waiting for it. And I've got on and bought what all did I buy? I've got a wireless adapter, the EDI Max wireless adapter. I've got a 16 gig card. I've got a power supply. I went and bought an HDMI to VGA converter. I've got a powered USB hub. So all this stuff has appeared. All the rest of my stuff has appeared, but there's no Pi yet. So it'll be here, I imagine, this week. So I've been kind of accumulating that stuff. I've continued to monkey with the Pi that I've got, and I have it now detecting faces. I don't know, maybe I had this for the last podcast. So it reliably detects faces in front of it and stuff. And I've started looking around at the what's going to be involved in face recognition on the Pi. So I've been working on that. And let's see, what else have I been up to? I've got a book that I bought a while back. So this is the Raspberry Pi week, I guess, called Raspberry Pi Projects for the Evil Genius. So I've been looking at that to try and figure out, okay, which of these projects am I likely to be able to actually afford the parts for and actually pay for? So it's been kind of a Pi dominated few days, and I have learned some Linuxy type things that anybody who knows anything about Linux, unlike myself, will already know these things. But I've learned about the joys of SSH-X to get into my Pi.
Oh yeah,
which is nice when you when I'm working with this camera software, so I run the Python program from an SSH session, and it pops up the window on my main box, which is very nice because it's hard to do that if you're on, you know, separate boxes or if you're logged into the Pi. So the other way to get in there is I remote in or X into, I've got a, I don't even know what client it is that I'm using to get it, to make a, it's an SSL, SSH, VNC viewer.
Oh, yeah.
That connects in, and so it brings me up a graphical window on the Pi. But as we have discussed before, the Pi is really not quite there as in terms of being a workable desktop. So if you're doing software development on the thing, it's not quite there. So this is much nicer because now I can fire up an editor on the Linux side, on the main side, on my main box here. And so I've got the drive mapped over. So I've got Genie or somebody running on the main box. That's where I'm editing the code, save it, pop to this SSH session, run the program, and the window pops up by itself. So it's all very 90s in its terms of its technology. This is the way that normal Unix people have worked for years and years, but it's kind of fun because I've never really had an environment where I needed to work that way, where I couldn't really just, you know, direct connect or VNC into a Linux box and have it work just fine. The Pi's just not that kind of a box. So that's been a lot of fun. And then the other Linuxy thing that I've done is, well, we'll talk about it a little later, but my poor old much-abused Chromebook has had a complete brain transplant. So it has a new personality and a new life. So more about that later in the show, as it were. So you'll have to listen through all these commercials to find out what that's all about. So how about you? What have you been up to, Joe, other than recording innumerable podcasts and stuff?
Apart from that, I bought a Chromebook.
You bought a Chromebook. Oh, well, happy times. This should be an interesting podcast then.
Yeah.
Actually, I knew that.
Yeah. After talking about it, I think 2 or 3 episodes ago, I think you weren't there. It was just me and Scott were talking about the possibility of booting from USB on it now with the latest firmware. And suddenly it became more attractive to me rather than having to mess around with Chroot environments and stuff, actually being able to do bare metal installs on it. And so I thought, well, yeah, let's have a look around. Which ones are there? And I settled on the Acer C720, which is the same one you've got, isn't it?
That's exactly the same machine I've got. Yep.
Yeah, which is... I think it's a Celeron, but it's quite a modern Celeron. It's about as good as an old Core 2 Duo. So it's not hugely fast, but it's fast enough. And it's got a 16 gig SSD, which is very much the kind of Achilles heel of it. 2 gigs of RAM. The more modern versions of it, I think you can get one with an i3 and a touchscreen.
Yes.
But the old one that I got, I paid £70 for it on eBay, which is pretty good going, I think.
Yeah, they're about, I think I paid $190 for it, which is probably, I don't know, where the euro's running.
Usually, whatever it is for in dollars, it will be in pounds here. I think it's a bit more than that, actually, for it new still.
Yeah, okay. This one was new, and this one was probably a year or so ago that I bought it. So I paid a bit more than that for it, but still, for a machine that's that size and capability, it's a pretty good price.
Yeah, not too bad. I mean, it's a bit worse for wear in terms of aesthetics. Someone tried to clean it with a solvent at one point, and so it's got kind of melted. Not melted, but you know that kind of solvent on plastic look.
It's world weary. It's kind of experienced.
Yeah, but it's perfectly functional. So what I wanted to do was set up a dual boot because Chrome OS uses very little space, and something like Lubuntu or even Zubuntu or even Mint, you could squeeze both of them on there.
Right.
And so I went through the process of getting, you have to make it up onto the dev channel first, and then you have to edit, you have to run a command to make it boot from
enable
USB.
Enable the USB boot stuff.
And then it's quite easy to boot Linux on it and install Linux on it. But the second that you touch any of the Chrome partitions with Gparted, Chrome refuses to boot anymore.
Ah.
And says it's damaged and please insert recovery media, which is very straightforward to do. You just plug it in and it just does it automatically.
And it returns it to factory default conditions. In other words, blows away anything you did to it.
Yeah. Except it doesn't blow away the ability to boot from USB still, though. Once you do that, because when you turn it on, you do Control L, and that gets you to the kind of proper bootloader. And then from there, you can boot anything you want on it. You have to, first of all, turn off operating system verification. So you don't...
Right, which is the thing that it checks to see whether the Chrome OS is damaged or not. Yeah.
No, that's different. I think the OS verification is to make sure... It's like secure boot, basically, making sure that it will only boot Chrome. But you can turn it off, thankfully. And so, effectively, if you buy one of these machines, and bear in mind I got this fairly cheap, I think, but for less than £100 secondhand, you can have something that's equivalent to a Core 2 Duo, the Celeron, with a couple of gigs of RAM. And if you're not bothered about running Chrome OS and trying to do a dual boot, you can get a nice little Linux box very, very cheap.
And they're very small, very lightweight. They're tablet-sized almost.
Yeah, well, it's actually more or less the same size as my little Vivo Book, which is my touchscreen i3 machine, but I paid $250 for that secondhand. So
yeah,
you're talking,
and that's a touch screen, and yeah,
yeah, and it's much more. Yeah. It's got a bigger, really fast SSD in it.
Now you can also there are places. Well, this turned into a Chromecast podcast, but there are places if you dig around online a little bit, you can find how to's to replace the SD card that's in this with a bigger one.
Yeah, I saw those, but they're quite expensive because it's not. It's not like a SATA drive, is it? It's a special kind of card one.
Yeah, there. I think you could put a 64 gig SSD in it for probably about $50 or $60.
Yeah, but that's getting on for what I paid for the machine in the first place.
Sure. Right? Yeah. That. Well, actually, and I looked at doing it, and then I thought, wait a minute, I paid $200 for this thing, and now I'm going to pay $75 just to put a bigger hard drive in. I don't. And in what universe is 16 gigabytes not enough storage space? Like, come on.
Well, anyway, yeah. You only need however many megabytes of RAM. No one will ever need more.
But, that's right. Yeah. 640 kilobytes. That's all that anybody's ever going to use.
Yeah. Sure. It's got the USB 3 port on it, and it's got an SD card reader. So the potential is there to expand the storage. But
yeah, I think that was the conclusion I came to afterwards was, well, you know, I really should just go and spend $30 on a 64 gig SSD card and plug that thing in. And then you got all the storage that you could probably want.
Yeah. So. But if anyone out there listening knows how to do the dual boot, how to get it set up so that you're booting Chrome OS and another proper Linux, then do let me know, because I am very keen to be able to do that. Even though it wouldn't make it that usable a machine, as we talked about with the expandable storage there, it's not so much of a problem if you use a fairly stripped down Linux distro.
Yeah, I had mine dual booting. XFCE was the desktop. I don't know if it was just a straight Debian or if it was Ubuntu, but that was running kind of inside Chrome OS.
Yeah, which I don't really count that as a dual boot because it's not really a bare metal installed. It's kind of a Chroot thing, which I haven't done yet and I would settle for, I suppose. I mean, I didn't buy this thing to use it. I've got plenty of laptops. I bought it to tinker with, really, and to get hands-on with Chrome OS and stuff like we're going to be talking about a little bit later on in the show. But yeah, leave a comment on the website or mintcast@mintcast.org if you know a proper way to get a bare metal dual boot going with the Chromebook.
I think it is possible. I just think that you can't monkey with the partitions that way.
You could potentially install Linux to an external drive, maybe, but I'd like to do
it. You could certainly do that and boot from like an SD card or something.
Yeah, but then it's going to be a bit slow. Even a USB 3 drive is going to be fairly slow. So I'd like to be able to do it all within the box, but from what I've read, and I haven't read that much, I don't think it's possible.
Oh, you think it's flat out not possible?
I don't think so, because I think the second you start touching those partitions, the Chrome OS partitions, that's when it just won't boot anymore. It thinks it's corrupt and damaged and it just will only give you the option to restore. But anyway, so later on in the show, we're going to be talking about Bodhi Linux 3.0.0, the new stable release of that. But for now, should we look at some news?
Sure, let's do that.
So a little bit of news out of the Mint camp this week, and it's a blog post on segfault.linuxmint.com, and that's about some recent Cinnamon development for version 2.6. And there's some kind of low-level stuff there, but a couple of things that jumped out at me were panel support for multiple monitors. You can now add panels to every monitor and configure them each individually. It's a work in progress by the sounds of things, and there are some bugs in it, but it's looking like eventually you will be able to get proper multi-panel support and also be able to move the panels around properly, which you haven't been able to before.
Yeah, this is a major, for me anyway, you know, this is one of these use cases that just drives you nutty when you run into something like this. And you know, my workaday Linux box is a Cinnamon box, and it's really and I use an external monitor with the notebook, and it's really a pain that you can't make that doggone panel go kind of wherever you want it. And it's very fiddly, you know, you can create another one and stuff like that, but the panel support has really just not been great. So this notion that you're going to be able to kind of stick one on each monitor, configure them differently, that I think is that's going to be a nice fit. I'm looking forward to that.
Yeah, I mean, that's one reason a lot of people would turn away from Cinnamon to Mate. So I think that it's been a long time coming, and hopefully they can get it sorted out and make it work properly. But the other thing is adding search providers to Cinnamon. Now, that's not something I would ever see a need for, but it does seem to be something that quite a lot of people seem to want to do.
Well, so I read this and I thought, okay, so this is in the actual search area instead of just looking for stuff on your drive.
Yeah, it can search things like Wikipedia and Yahoo and presumably Google. It sounds a little bit familiar, doesn't it?
Yeah, I think I was sitting here thinking, now I've seen this before somewhere. Who was it that did this? That wasn't search providers, Lenses or something, isn't that?
Yeah.
Wait a minute. So you're going to send all my search stuff automatically to Google now?
Yeah, but to put it as an option, and it sounds like it is going to be an option and definitely not a default, I don't think that many people will be interested in it. I certainly wouldn't, but perhaps there are people who like that feature in Unity. If it's not searching Amazon, if it's more searching Wikipedia, that's I search Wikipedia all the time, and I do it in the browser, but maybe you haven't got a browser open. Maybe you're trying to stay away from the internet, you know, the web, but you do want to quickly search, look something up on Wikipedia. So that could be.
So the example that they show in the Segfault site that caught my eye was an app search.
Mm.
And that would be very useful because, you know, I'm going along and they're saying, oh yeah, you need, you know, is Ruby installed? Well, okay, no, I don't know. Okay, so half the time you go apt install Ruby and it says, oh, there's no package called Ruby.
Yeah.
So it's like, guess again. It's like, okay, well, so having it kind of go find me packages in apt, and actually what would be lovely would be if it would search for the packages I have installed and say, oh yeah, so I type in search and so here are app packages that you have installed and ones that you haven't installed, but you could if you wanted to, sort of thing. If it would show me stuff like that, I think that would be very handy.
Yeah, I think that they've got to play it properly and carefully and not just jump into making it default searching things like Amazon, like Ubuntu.
Yeah, that was a big, I think, a big oops mistake and is not Minty in kind of nature. Mint's kind of approach has traditionally been much more privacy aware than what Ubuntu's is, I guess, so.
Yeah, well, let's wait and see, but I hope that they won't mess it up, yeah.
So this is all going into, what, 2.6? Is that what they said? Yeah, Cinnamon 2.6.
Yeah.
Which heaven only knows when that's going to come out. I suppose that will come out...
potentially in April, if they do a 17.3.
Yeah, maybe so. Well, it's good to see them all continuing to work on it anyway. You'd hate to see it sort of disappear because nobody was working on it. I'm still looking for my LibreOffice backport into 17, by the way. But, yeah. You know, that's a different topic, I know.
Yeah,
I know.
And 17.2 is what I meant for anyone out there listening. Sergeant McBear and the IRC pointed that out. Yeah, as soon as I said 17.3, I knew I should have said 17.2.
17.2, yeah. So our next story is one that has been kind of echoing around a little bit. I think we talked on the last show about the demise of Crunchbang.
Mm.
So Core Nominal announced, yeah, okay, so, you know, the world has changed. He's moving on and made the comment, I think, on the Crunchbang website that he felt like in many ways Crunchbang wasn't needed anymore. And so of course there was a big hue and cry in the community. And so now I ran across this post on FastForced by Larry Caffiero that's entitled Crunchbang, the rest of the story. And so he's playing off a trope. I don't know if Paul Harvey is a name that is familiar in outside the US, but anyways, a radio commentator, and used to end a lot of his radio broadcasts. And so now you know the rest of the story. Uh-huh. And I can't do his voice well, but he had a very distinctive way of saying it. So it's become a bit of a meme. Anyway, so Larry, in his article, says, here's the rest of the story concerning the successors, spins, or forks of CrunchBang. The tech media is falling over itself, reporting that the successor to CrunchBang is something called CrunchBang++, which to many CrunchBang insiders is nothing more than one, but not the resurrection project based on CrunchBang. It's a project that appears, in the opinion of many CrunchBang contributors, as one that's trying to capitalize on the name now that it's, quote, available. However, many longtime CrunchBang contributors, forum moderators, of which I am one, he says, have banded together to form what is now being called Bunsen Labs, named after the Muppets' top scientist, Dr. Bunsen Honeydew, perhaps, to preserve the spirit of the technological simplicity initiated by CrunchBang and combine it with maintaining the spirit of openness and helpfulness that was the hallmark of the CrunchBang community. So the interesting thing is that, you know, I heard this story as well about this CrunchBang++ and thought, oh, good, you know, a bunch of the CrunchBang guys have decided that, you know, they're going to keep the project going and stuff like that, only to find out that that's actually not really what's going on, that this is just sort of one group of people who are claiming to own kind of the process and are putting themselves forward as being the carrying on group, if you will, when in fact there are a bunch of different folks that are looking at, you know, what should we do with this? And you know, maybe there's going to be a meeting at Scale 13X about what they're going to do about a successor distro to CrunchBang, if there is one. And, you know, he's quick to point out, again, this is just one successor. There's going to be more than one. And, you know, just settle down here. It's not that this is the one and only successor. So thought that was kind of an interesting little wrinkle that I suppose ought not to be surprising, in the sense that this is the internet and this is Linux and you can kind of do whatever you want, I suppose, and say whatever you want. So you have to kind of pay attention a little bit. So,
yeah, you're going to have that kind of fractal effect, aren't you? It's just going to keep splitting and splitting. People are never going to, well, it's hard enough to organize people into one project as CrunchBang was. And now that Quinomenal has decided to give that up, you've got all the people kind of scurrying around and forming bands and groups. So you're probably going to get at least two. I mean, that's sure, generally what happens with these things.
Yeah.
It'd be good if it could have just carried on. And I think that he underestimated the number of people who wanted it to carry on, because he talked about how it had become irrelevant. But
yeah.
So if he could have handed the reins over, perhaps that might have been a better way to play it, rather than now we've got this confusion and some people saying you can just do it with a vanilla Debian and other people saying that it's not quite that straightforward.
Yeah, multiple people claiming to be the, you know, the one true successor, and it confuses things. And I think I think you're right. You know, he just underestimated the impact that he was having and that CrunchBang was having on the community.
Yeah.
So as a follow-on to that, there's an article over on Datamation entitled "The Dangers of Boutique Linux Distros." These small, more adventurous Linux distros have some clear advantages, but be aware of the downsides. So he says, every time a new boutique Linux distro rolls out in the limelight, it seems the same two thoughts cross my mind. First, the distro's developer must be excited to present their vision to potential users and work hard to provide the best distro possible. Second, this also means that if something happens to the developer, the project can end instantly in its tracks. And so he goes, the article written by a guy by the name of Matt Hartley goes on to talk about distros and kind of how they're different and kind of why they're, you know, a lot of people say, oh, we ought to just have one distro and they're all the same anyway. And so he makes the point that no, they really are different in flavor and in the ideas that they're trying to put forward. And then he specifically talks about Crunch Bang and the distro that it was and about the shutdown and this new project called Crunch Bang Plus Plus, and concludes that, well, so if the distro's got enough people with it, somebody's willing to pick it up, and little projects like Crunch Bang can disappear in the blink of an eye. And he sort of asks the question, you know, is this a good thing? You know, are these little distros, he's not worried about the big ones, but the little ones, are they a problem? And he ends up in concluding by saying, I'm a fan of the smaller boutique Linux distros available today. I love the idea of trying something new or simply attempting to look at a new way of installing my favorite Linux software. It's exciting, keeps me interested in a platform that has seen tremendous amount of maturity in recent years. I, for one, welcome all the Linux distros available on all and those yet to be developed. So he comes away with, I think, what I would call a hobbyist computer guy's kind of attitude. He really likes just tinkering with Linux. And so for somebody like that, things like Crunch Bang and even Bodhi that we're going to talk about here in a minute and all these little, and Arch, they're all enormously fun to tinker with. And so that's a great reason to have distros. We've talked in the past on more than one occasion about, you know, the fracturing of the resource space and the confusion in people's minds that's caused by there being just simply too many different distros floating around. So I don't know, where do you come down on this decision or on this kind of idea, Joe? Are you in favor of the existence of things like Crunch Bang, or are you, you ought to just all go use Debian?
Well, I think that there's two different questions there. Little boutique distros, and you could argue that something like TinyCore is a little boutique distro. I'm very in favor of them existing, and they're the kind of thing that I want to test out and play with, but they're not going to go on my main boxes. I'm going to go for an Ubuntu-based LTS, you know, something based on an Ubuntu LTS, be it Mint, be it Zubuntu, be it Ubuntu Mate, whatever, so that I know that I've got stability there. And I think that they're kind of two different types of people, aren't there? There's the people who just want to get stuff done and just have one machine, and so that's why Linux Mint is ideal for them, or even Ubuntu, if they can handle Unity, just stick it on and that's it. Whereas then you've got people like us who are more into dual and triple and quad, etc., booting their machines and have multiple old laptops lying around and old desktops, and we play with different distros. So the hobbyist word is the right one, I think, that you said there. I mean, as for Crunch Bang, I kind of covered it last time on the show, where we were talking about how it is fairly straightforward to make Crunch Bang out of Debian and scripts and theming and stuff. And so it is arguably a little bit redundant, but then I like to be able to just download an ISO and install something. So I'm kind of torn on whether resources should be split like that, or whether people should, you know, all the development that went into Crunch Bang could have gone into mainline Debian and made Debian better, couldn't it?
Right. And so I think the point in the article that I took away was, yeah, you know, these little distros, this is where at least some of, maybe not all of, the innovation in Linux comes from, is that somebody gets a wild idea about how they should do something, and so they're free to just go and do as they see fit and demonstrate it, and it either works and the world loves it and comes and beats a path to the door, or it's an abysmal failure and we never hear about them again. The ones that I think are, that I would agree with you on, are the ones that, you know, where somebody takes an existing distro and they change the theme on the desktop, and say, oh, this is my new distro. See how it's different. And it sort of looks different, but it's basically exactly the same thing. It's just themed differently. Okay. So that's a waste of time and is unnecessarily confusing for people, I think, to have things like that exist. And I don't know how you'd decide on, well, how much of a change does there have to be before this is, you know, worthy of being considered a separate distro. I don't know. And maybe it's better that we're not able to set those guidelines. I think the marketplace votes. Mm. You know, they like things like Mint because it's, you could argue it's just scripts and themings and a little code on top of Ubuntu, but it's enough different that it's attracted a following of its own. What was the one that was a, there was one that was a derivative of Mint that had a different coloring scheme or something, and people, those things just disappear. So I don't know, maybe that, maybe it's self-regulating, but yeah, I'm going to want to use something that's stable. You know, when I sit down to actually do things using my Mint box, I want it to be stable. When I sit down and do things to my Mint box, I don't care so much then.
Yeah. Yeah,
precisely. So, you know, are you doing it to your computer or are you doing it on your computer?
Yeah, with it.
Yeah, well, okay, this could go the wrong direction. Never mind. Forget I said that. We may have to cut that out.
Well, speaking of tinkering with distros and stuff, we talked about Raspberry Pis at the top of the show, and in the last couple of weeks, I think it's only been since the Raspberry Pi 2 Model B was released, 500,000 have been sold. And so there's 500,000 out there, and still you haven't got it, Rob.
It's still not here. It's in the mail, though. I ordered it, what, 3 weeks ago? Yeah, right before the last show, I ordered it, and they shipped it. And the U.S. Postal Service said, it'll be here yesterday. It was supposed to be here the 21st, and it's not here yet.
But anyway, so it's the fastest selling British computer.
I know. Is it the only British computer? Is there another one? Wait, no,
come
on.
We used to have them back in the 80s, but and they used to be ARM-based and run RISC OS, so the things haven't really changed in the last 30 years. But they only expected to sell 10,000 units.
Of the original Raspberry Pi, that's what they figured they were going to sell. Maybe, yeah.
Yeah, and they've actually sold 5 million.
Yeah. Isn't that amazing? How many people do you know that have two or three of these things?
Well, I've got two, so there's one.
I wish I had two. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, a friend of mine, he bought three of them. Just, he didn't know why, but you know, he said they're $25. I'll find something to do with it.
And I bet they're just gathering dust now, aren't they?
Well, he made a doorbell out of one of them, I think.
Yeah. I mean, that's the question. Of those 5 million, how many are actually being used on a daily basis?
For anything, yeah.
Yeah.
Not 5 million of them, that's certainly for sure.
Yeah. And quite an interesting thing that there's a Raspberry Pi going to the International Space Station.
Well, because there's a... Who knew that the UK had... An astronaut? Really? You guys got an astronaut?
Yeah, we're doing it all these days.
Wow. I'm amazed. You know, it's just, you guys are very progressive.
Yeah, yeah. And so it's going up to the International Space Station, and the blog that we'll link to, well, the post on ZDNet, he's talking about how it's really exciting that kids in classrooms in the UK and around the world, in fact, potentially, we'll have the exact same hardware that is going to be doing experiments on the International Space Station. And the thesis here from Jamie Watson is that kids are going to be really excited by that. And I would like to think that there will be some kids excited by that, but I don't know, the kind of kids that I see around London on the streets smoking and getting into trouble, I can't see it, but I think there will be some more intelligent kids who will be excited by that. And they're going to have a competition as well for kids to design an experiment. And the best one is going to actually be performed up in space. So I think that there will certainly be a section of kids who will be really excited by that possibility.
I think that's really cool that they're doing that. Just, you know, so you're going to fly a computer in space. Whoop-de-doo. But the notion of kind of inspiring people to say, you know, I got one of these things sitting here on my desk, and it's going to do the same thing that they're doing in space. And what would be really cool is if they could figure out how to connect these things together, the space thing together with the one that is in my house, and so that they could somehow talk, or they, you know, some cool thing like that that would, you know, I think that would draw a lot of people's attention, both back to the space program, which I think is sorely in need of some excitement, and to computing, which was the original thesis for the existence of the Pi. So,
well, just wait till that reality show starts. They've selected the candidates now, haven't they, for that one-way trip to Mars?
For the Mars thing, yeah. They had like 200,000 people apply.
And you had to pay to apply, didn't you, to kind of weed out the crazies?
Yeah. So, it didn't work very well.
Okay, to weed out the extreme crazies.
The maybe. Obvious crazies, yeah. So they weeded it, got it down to 1,000 or so. I'm going by memory. I saw the news article this week, and now they're down to what? What is it down to, 100 people now
Something
or
like
so?
That, yeah.
Last 100. And this is the craziest thing. So the notion is that they put you in a rocket and they send you to Mars, and there's no way back, and they know that. And so it's a matter, you know, you're there for as long as you can stay alive, sort of thing. And the establishment, the scientists that are in charge of such things, you know, they're claiming, oh yeah, they won't last. It'll be months before people start dying. They won't last very long. If that, yeah, they're not going to last very long at all, which is why they don't want to send anybody, of course. But this is interesting, you know, and maybe they're right. I don't know. Maybe they're not. Mm. Would you do it?
Absolutely not.
Neither would I.
Send a robot maybe that I was in complete control of, and, you know, could have virtual reality and, you know, have the virtual experience of being there. But until it's as simple as getting on a plane and flying over to the US, I'm afraid I might be going into space.
It's not in my mentality, I guess. I don't know what it is about me. It takes, so Sergeant McBear says, how many months does it take to get there? I think it's like 18 months or something it takes to get there, or 6 months or something, because they have to take a minimum energy orbit. Bill M.I. says maybe 4 months. Yeah, so we're all just wildly.
It depends on the
guesses,
alignment of the planets, doesn't it? They've got to be, because sometimes the planets are much further away from each other. But,
right, and so you pick your time so that you launch, take off at the right time, and you're following this minimum energy trajectory from one orbit to the other, and so it's longer than just hopping in the car and driving straight to Mars.
Yeah,
you know, you go around the Earth or around the Sun. A little ways to, as you're, let me think, the further out you are, the slower you're going. So they got to figure out how they get, you know, they got to wait for Mars to catch up. And you could look it up in the internet, I'm sure, and figure out how long it was. But yeah, still, I'm not going
to
go.
Anyway, I better pretend to be Scott and say, right, that's enough going off into the weeds with that. Shall we move on to the main topic and talk about Bodhi?
I think we probably should.
So it says in the show doc that we talked to Jeff Hoogland back in August 2012. Well, we is a good word there, because it wasn't me, was it? I actually listened to it today. It wasn't even you, was it, Rob?
No, I wasn't even on it either. I must have missed that show. I remember talking to somebody, or I remember that somebody was talking about Bodhi and enlightenment on the show, and I couldn't remember the specifics. And so I went digging back in the archives. And found out, oh yeah, there it is, show 126. Then I went and looked for it. Oh, that's one of the ones that we hadn't uploaded online yet. So there's a gap from about maybe the low hundreds into the 140 region, where there are a whole pile of podcasts that are missing because they were on our old server when it died. So, and I've just been too lazy to get them up there. So this was one of them. So I went and tracked down the audio file and uploaded it. And of course, the audio quality is
it's
a little bit dodgy. It's dodgy enough that we actually got a comment from a listener, Merely Jim, who said, oh, I couldn't even listen to it. It was so bad.
Yeah,
so I don't know. That was
something
that bad,
strange going on with it. But
Anyway, so it was Scott and James.
Yeah.
Had Jeff on, and they were talking about E17, I think. There must have just been a release, or E17 had just come out or something. So that's what the conversation was about. So if you go to our website and go find episode 126, the audio file is up on archive.org now, so you can actually go and listen to that and find out what Scott had to say about Bode. And actually, a lot of the questions that they were asking about it then are questions that I think I still have now. Yeah, so neither you nor I was on the podcast, but Mintcast, the entity, was there.
Yeah, yeah. And Jeff Hoogland, who, of course, is the lead dev of Bode. And Bode is actually a synonym for enlightenment. And that's something I learned from listening to that today.
Yeah, that it's a Sanskrit word.
Yes, it's the Sanskrit word for enlightenment.
For enlightenment, yeah.
So that shows how the Enlightenment desktop is it's not all that Bode is, but it is. That's what it's about, isn't it? It's an Ubuntu based on the LTS,
right?
With Enlightenment desktop,
and it's Enlightenment, and it's this elementary widget set. And the Enlightenment desktop and the EDL or the EFL, the Enlightenment Foundation libraries. So it's all about this kind of vision of the desktop that is what I think defines Bode in a lot of ways. Yeah.
Yeah. And so around August 2012, when Jeff was on the show, that must have been when version 2 had come out, which would have been based on the 1204 LTS. And so now there is the version that's based on 1404, which is, well, it's a little bit late, isn't it, really? Because we're looking almost at 1504 now. And that, I think that there's been quite a lot going on with the Bode community. And Jeff stood down, didn't he? He didn't have time to do
that. Yeah, and I didn't really dig into all of that, although I do remember that he'd stepped down, and then he's now... I don't know how long ago, it wasn't all that long ago that I think we probably announced on here news-wise that he had decided that he was going to re-energize things and come back again. And
yeah, and so a bit of a spoiler, you can feel that there's been a bit of a ruckus in it. Well, not a ruckus in the community, but things haven't been plain sailing for it, and you can feel that. But the stable release is upon us anyway, version 3.0.0. And, well, who wants to go first? You installed it on the Chromebook, did you?
Well, so, as we were talking about this ahead of time, we both have Chromebooks. And so I thought, oh, yeah, or Joe suggested, actually, yeah, we should look at this and look at it on a Chromebook. So I thought, I've been pretty happy with my Chrome OS, but there are some things that it didn't really... do properly. So I thought, yeah, okay, I'll have a look at it. But I thought, oh, I'll do it in a VM first. So I fired up VirtualBox and installed it, downloaded both versions, installed it in the VM. And, the installation is pretty much flawless, at least on a VM. I didn't try it on regular hardware. Because I was going to do the Chromebook, I figured, but I thought, well, I'll have a look at it. So the installation went fine. It detects everything. It's a little bit dodgy in terms of its support for VirtualBox, and this is something that's discussed off and on around the on the Bode forums. Is this the VirtualBox stuff that they've got installed in there is just enough to get it to work sort of tolerably well, but not enough to make it really sing. And to do that, you have to uninstall. I don't know that I ever really figured out even how to do this. You have to uninstall the stuff that's there and then reinstall the VirtualBox extensions. And it just is a huge pain in the neck to actually make it work. So I don't think I ever really got it to... Well, I didn't even try it. Just after reading, the headaches that people have gone through to try and make it work, I thought, okay, this is just not really even worth doing. So things that don't work, like what works is the mouse integration. You know, how it automatically grabs and releases the mouse as you go over top. So simple things like that work fine. But the resolution rescaling doesn't work, and apparently all that stuff would work fine without it. Bodhi itself and under the hood, of course, it's just Ubuntu, right? It's an Ubuntu 14.04 LTS core, Linux 3.16 kernel. If you don't look at Enlightenment, it's not anything special at all, really. What else can I say? It's a minimalist sort of install in the sense that it's one of these things that you install it and it goes in a flash. It takes no time at all for it to install. And it's always been like that. But when it fires up, there's nothing there, hardly. There's just enough to get the system up, gets Enlightenment running. There's a little text editor. There's icons. There's, wireless stuff and some system tools, theming, that sort of stuff. But it's really, there's nothing there other than just the box itself. And then the idea is that you go and install stuff, whatever you want. You know, they presume that you're going to go and install whatever packages you want. And that all works reasonably well. If what you want is a DVD or an installation that's like Mint that you put it in, and probably everything that 80% of the whole planet is going to use is installed right out of the box, Bodhi is not that. You're going to spend a bunch of time afterwards figuring out, oh yeah, I want an Office Suite on here. Oh yeah, I need to put VLC on here. Oh yeah, I need to have, you know, this, that, or whatever it is. You know, I got to put HexChat. I got to put everything is there. You have to put everything on yourself.
Which quite suits me, actually. And it certainly suits the Chromebook because, as I said, the one we've got, the C720, has only got 16 gig SSD in it. So you really want a minimal installation. You don't want loads of craft that you're not ever going to use. And
right.
The thing is that there's a few ways to install software. Either you can just do standard apt-get install, which is what I would do, or you could install Synaptic and do it that way, but then you would have had to install Synaptic first. Or they've got a big... It's hard to describe it, really.
It is. It's unlike any other thing that I have seen around the Linux world for package management. And it took me the longest time to actually figure out what it was.
Yeah. It's a database where you can either search it or you can go in by categories. And so say you go into web browsers and you've got Firefox and Chromium there. And if you click on Chromium and you click on install, it's an apt URL. So that, yeah. At the moment, I'm in Zubuntu, and if I click on that, it opens the Ubuntu Software Center. So it feels like an almost Windows-like way of doing things, where you browse the web for the EXE and click on it and install it, whereas all it's really doing is telling your system to run apt-get install, in this case, Chromium-browser or VLC or whatever. So it kind of feels...
It's just a web page. It's all it is.
Yeah, just a web page with a link that isn't even a web link. It's a link on your system.
Now, the system, when you first install it, comes with Midori as the web browser.
Yeah.
Which I don't know. I just couldn't stand it. It's
yeah, it's a bit...
Oh, well, it's too minimalist.
Yeah.
You know, I've really gotten used to a heavier weight web browser than that. But in Midori, when you go to the App Center, you click on something, it just installs it. It looks and feels like the Software Center. And so it took me a little while, I'm being the dense idiot that I am, took me a while to figure out, oh, wait, this is a web page. Wait a minute. Because it looks and feels like the Software Center. The nice thing is that they have gone through and for each kind of class of software, they've picked the top, 2 to 7 applications that they think most people are going to want to use.
Yeah.
Everything is there. because it's just Ubuntu, but they have kind of picked out the ones that they thought were the right ones. And so mostly that's what I've installed. I've installed a couple of other things now since then, but mostly I've just been going through and saying, oh yeah, okay, I want a chat client. Yeah, I want Hex Chat on there. Email, yeah, I'll take Thunderbird. Yeah, that's good. File manager, now nah, whatever you got on there is okay. Didn't put any games on, didn't put any icon sets on. Multimedia, VLC is in there. So your standard test installation, boom, just installs it.
Yeah.
So
no problems. Yeah.
So that part was nice. But so if that's all it was for me anyway, on, you know, standard hardware, you know, my, workaday world, notebook, I can't see myself installing it, to be quite honest, and using it. It doesn't offer enough difference from Mint, for example, to say, yeah, you really want to do this, unless you just really liked Enlightenment.
Yeah, or if you've got really old hardware, and that's something that we probably should have mentioned, that there are four ISOs that you can download, the 32-bit standard, the 64-bit standard, then the legacy, which works with non-PAE processors. Now, I might have one ancient box that doesn't support PAE. So that, I mean, the fact that they are supporting that means that you can really run it on ancient hardware. And the requirements are so low that it will really run on almost anything. And then you've got the Chromebooks, which are specifically for a few different Chromebooks, including the C720, because if you install Ubuntu or Mint, the touchpad won't work on the C720 because you need kernel modules. It's fairly straightforward, I think, to do that. I haven't done that yet, but from what I've read, it doesn't seem particularly difficult.
If you go look on the wiki, it talks about, you know, well, what is this Chromebook distro? And it's just the standard one, but it's got kind of a bunch of hardware drivers that are not sort of standard part of the kernel. It's got them automatically included.
Yeah, but it also has got a 3.11 kernel rather than a 3.16.
Ah, I hadn't noticed that.
To put that in some context, Ubuntu 14.04 has got a 3.13 kernel, so it's actually even older. That's also interesting that the main edition has got the 3.16 kernel. So it's got the same kernel as Ubuntu 14.10, despite the fact that the distro is based on 14.04. So it's kind of a little bit like the Linux Mint thing, where they've backported a later kernel into it.
Oh, that is interesting. Yeah.
Yeah. So one of the reasons to use Bodhi, I think, is really old hardware, or if you like Enlightenment. Now, I don't like Enlightenment, I'm afraid. I've spun it up a few times before to check it out, and I've never really cared for it. And to me, the default state of this particular release, it looks, dare I say it, Amiga-ish. And I always go back to that era. I had, I think, the Amiga 500 Plus, and before that I had an Amstrad, and I wouldn't insult it to say it looks that old, but you know how Damn Small Linux and Tiny Core have got that kind of really old school 90s look about them?
Big kind of clunky icons and
yeah. And so this has got a similar look and feel to me to that. It feels and looks very, very old to me in terms of the styling. As far as I know, it's quite easy to change that, but I wasn't really going to start trying to make it better. I mean, particularly as Jeff has said that in that interview a couple of years ago, or 3 years ago, whatever it was, that it's fairly straightforward to make Enlightenment look really good. And that's what we've done. And I don't, perhaps it's a taste thing, but if that's as good as Enlightenment gets, then there's not much point trying to theme it, I don't think. I think you just got to accept that it's not going to look great, but it is going to function pretty well.
You know, that's interesting. The look didn't bother me. It's a little bit cartoonish. And so as I'm sitting here looking at it in the virtual box, it's jarringly less professional looking than Cinnamon is.
Yeah. I mean, I booted up Ubuntu Mate, and it was unbelievable, the difference. I've been staring at it all day, Enlightenment, and then to look at Ubuntu Mate, which isn't amazingly beautiful or anything, it just looks fairly modern, and they've done a reasonable job of it. No complaints, but that was a jarring difference there.
Yeah, I thought, I hadn't really registered, but I remember thinking as I'm working on this, thinking, you know, this just doesn't look grown-up adult-like. And I couldn't put my finger on what it was, that it didn't look like it had been designed people talk about, these design issues and UI designer issues and stuff like that. This didn't look like it had been designed that way. Although, as I'm using it, it's clearly just Linux and it works just fine. And, you know, there's nothing really wrong with it, I don't think. I'm in the sense that I'm quite happy with it. Even the ePad, the little text editor, the icons are a little big and clunky, but it doesn't look bad. You know, I could see myself using it. It looks fine. There are a couple of odd little things about the way that Enlightenment works that I'm not sure I'm real happy with, but...
Let's talk about the dock, for example. You've got, by default, a small panel, or what looks like a panel, at the top of the screen, which you can right-click and find in an awkward menu somewhere. You can move it around anywhere you want. I want it in the bottom of the screen, ideally. And then what you've got there is essentially a poor man's OS X dock, really, where you can drag and drop things on and off it, icons, shortcuts. And then once you click on them, that you get a little kind of light to say that they're active. And then it's almost like a cross between the OS X dock and the Windows 7 taskbar, where instead of having to click on the icon to see the various windows that are available, you just mouse over it. And if you've got two instances of something, of a program, two Firefox windows, for example, and you mouse over that the taskbar button in Windows 7, you'll get a little preview of the two that are available.
Right.
And similarly, in OS X, if you click on the dock item, then you'll get a little animation that previews the two of them. And so it's kind of halfway in between those two, really. And it doesn't suit my workflow. I generally prefer a hierarchical menu, which it has, but all of the menus seem to just be two or three or four or more levels deep. And that just doesn't seem like a good way to do things to me. It's you're constantly battling with the menus, and if you're on a little touchpad like you are with the Chromebook, really you have to be quite nimble to actually get to anything. And it made me think that why haven't they, if they're going to go for an OS X style dock, why don't they go for some sort of launcher? Like, are you aware of Sling's Cold launcher?
Nope. So I'm using the Cairo Docker I don't know what this Cairo, what is it, a shelf manager or?
It's kind of a dock, really. Yeah. Well, I know it from Cairo Dock anyway.
Yeah, Cairo Dock's what I'm using on this Cinnamon box.
Right. But what Sling's Cold is, have you any experience with OS X at all?
Very little bit, no.
Okay, well, I think it's called Launchpad, which is quite funny. And it's essentially a full screen launcher with on a tablet or a phone, where you've just got big icons and it's quite touch friendly, but it's also mouse friendly, and you can also search it a little bit like the Unity Dash. So I can't help but think that if they're going to go for a dock based navigation and window management, then they should have a launcher rather than because docks are kind of a fairly modern ish way of doing things, whereas the hierarchical menu is quite an old school way of doing things. And to have two real extremes, one hierarchical menu where you have to really dig through three or four sometimes levels of it, and also to have the dock, just doesn't seem to marry up to me. And I would, for the ease of putting in something like Sling's Cold, which I actually did with it, and it worked reasonably well, I don't think it would be particularly difficult for them to implement something like that.
Hmm. Yeah, it's not something I had no. I had just sort of been treating that dock as being sort of one of the defining characteristics almost of enlightenment, because other than that, I can't really, you know, as a desktop environment, it's sort of hard to see much difference between, you know, well, okay, what is enlightenment as opposed to cinnamon? You know, it's, well, I got a desktop and the, you know, clicking here and there seems to do slightly different things and is a bit counterintuitive to what I would have suspected. But then all of these desktops do that. You know, right-clicking on cinnamon brings up a menu. Right-clicking on enlightenment on the desktop background doesn't do anything.
Yeah, right-click, it generally doesn't do much apart from on the panels and stuff.
On the panel. But left-clicking does what it does on, is it OpenBox or XFCE that pops up a hierarchical menu if you left-click or if you click on the desktop?
Yeah, I think with XFCE, you can configure it a few different ways, but it's right-click generally. And I think with OpenBox, it's right-click as well. So it's, I think, what's the one that, I think OpenBox, the puppy, the one, I can't remember what that's called now, but that I think is left-click. And so I found that a bit strange as well, that you're trying to right-click and nothing happens.
Yeah, and yet, you know, I'm just going to click on the desktop, and oh, up pops this goofy menu. Oh, yeah, all right. Because half the time, my other grouch is that it's really, really hard to resize windows.
Yeah.
And half the time when I do it, I end up clicking on the desktop and bringing that goofy menu thing up. Because you have to get it positioned exactly right, and you have to look for this little white blinky dot thing that appears when you're positioned right, and then you can click, and then you can resize the window.
Yeah.
So, yeah. So, enlightenment, I don't know. I think I'm going to leave it on the Chromebook because, well, so actually, let me back up. We haven't really talked about the Chromebook thing. So, have you done anything on the Chromebook with it yet?
Most of what I looked at was on the Chromebook. I did install it on my test laptop, my Big Vio, as well. But most of what I've got to say about it is from the Chromebook. And yeah, I did just blew away Chrome OS and did a bare metal installation. And I must say that it wasn't the best experience. You boot into it in the first place, and it just segfaults straight away. To be fair, it does recover itself very well, but it kept crashing. I kept getting segfaults with it. I opened the installer, that crashed, then it recovered, and I managed to install it. And that feeling of being crashy and unstable generally continues throughout. I mean, when I installed it on my Vio, Midori just kept crashing all the time, just constantly. I was just looking at a web page with some instructions for, I think, actually something else I was doing at the same time. I was multitasking, and it just kept crashing. And the hardware support as well for the Vio isn't brilliant. Every time I reboot it, the screen's really dark, but the function key to adjust the brightness doesn't work. So you have to find it buried in a menu, and then it's supposedly set at full brightness, but then you have to just tweak it down to 98, and then suddenly it's much brighter again. And so you have to do that every time. So there are a lot of bugs. I mean, I could go on about a lot of the bugs in it, but I don't think that's particularly interesting. Suffice to say, I found both of the installations that I did, the 64-bit main edition and the Chromebook edition, to be quite buggy and fairly unstable. And I can't help but think that that's because Jeff has been away raising kids and whatever he's been doing. And he's come back, and it's been a bit of a rush job to get this out the door, I think.
I have had as nearly as possible the exact opposite experience with it on the Chromebook. The installation was just flawless. You know, I did a backup, so I ran the Chrome backup, because I've been using this Chromebook for, I don't know, 6 months or a year or so now, with Chrome OS on it. And so I thought, well, I better back up the current states, which I did, onto a USB stick. And then I copied the ISO just DD'd the ISO onto another USB stick, went through the process of switching to developer mode and then enabling the legacy boot and all that stuff that you have to do in the Chromebook, and then stuffed in the USB drive and powered the sucker on, control L. It boots up cleanly into Bodhi. And it shows you the getting stuck, you know, it opens up Midori and a whole pile of things. So I closed that and just clicked on the install Bodhi. And it basically, then you switch from the Chromebook installation to the Bodhi station instructions, and you just follow along the normal, instructions, and, it all just, everything worked. I told it to take the whole drive. So it just blew away whatever was there, and took over the whole disk. Let me just see.
This does sound more or less what happened to me. After it had recovered itself a couple of times, that was what I found. It's just
I didn't get any seg faulting. I didn't get nothing like that happened, and hasn't from in the whole time I've been running it. You know, I've been using it to do, I edited the show notes and I was looking for this, that, and the other thing on it. And so I've been installing software and I installed OpenOffice on it, copied a bunch of stuff back and forth and have been fiddling with it. Absolutely flawless. And I've suspended it, you know, closed the lid, it suspends, open it back up again. I type my password in, boom, it's back again. That's something that I had set it up to do. All of the buttons seem to work. The brightness and stuff buttons work. The volume control buttons all work. Everything just seems to work. I haven't had anything that didn't work. Well, with one exception. I was out of the house this morning over at the church and powered the thing on and thought, oh, good, I'll get it connected to another Wi-Fi. You know, I'll just check it over there and see if I could not get it to scan Wi-Fi. Now, then this is a Linux thing, not necessarily a Bodhi thing, except that, and so that, you know, I'm just not familiar enough about how Wi-Fi works on Linux to have been able to come up off the top of my head and figure out how to make it work. I think it's not a hard thing to do once you've got your Wi-Fi foo straightened out on Linux. But for something, you know, that is, you're going to put it on a Chromebook and is going to be a replacement for what was on the Chromebook. The Chromebook, you just turn it on and there's no Wi-Fi. So you click on the Wi-Fi and it says, oh, let me go, here's some. Why don't you want to connect to this? You know, it automatically scans. This guy, you power him back up after he's been down and he said, oh, the Wi-Fi you were on is gone. And so it's like, okay, well, find me another one then. Nothing I did would cause it to rescan. And I think my ignorance is showing here. I tried shutting the interface down, bringing it back up again. That didn't auto scan. I half-heartedly tried IW config, but I couldn't remember the commands. And then I ran out of time and it's like, okay, never mind. I got to go do something else now. So I haven't got time to fix this. That seems to me something like Bodhi, that is going to be on a Chromebook where the only connection you've got to the world is Wi-Fi. You have to make the Wi-Fi absolutely rock solid because that's your only internet connection. You don't have a wired connection on these things.
Yeah.
So that has to work. And so that's the sole place it has failed me so far. And I very rapidly changed away from the default theme too. I didn't like the default theme very much.
Mm. One thing that's somewhat off topic, but with the Chromebook, have you tried to boot Linux Mint on it?
I have not. I haven't tried to. This is my first test at actually running, you know, a full blown Linux distro on the bare metal. I had one running in a truded kind of way some time ago, and then managed to. Oh, I know what I did. When 1404 came out, I think there was an update for it. So I said, oh yeah, install that. Well, that just scrugged it six ways from breakfast. You can't do that.
Okay.
And I never got it put back on again.
I tried today just out of interest because I wanted to see how Linux Mint Mate Edition would compare to Bodhi.
Yeah, how much of it would actually work? That's what I was worried about. Because it, you know, Bodhi says, "Oh yeah, we've got all these special drivers," and so I thought, "Oh well, okay." That.
Well,
so how? What was your experience with Mint then?
My experience was, put the flash drive in, turn it on, Control L, you get the standard, you know, boot Mint now. Press that, and then you get black screen with white writing on it that says, "Not enough memory to boot this image." And I tried that with the 32-bit Cinnamon and Mate editions. And I thought, hang, surely 2 gigabytes is enough memory
to boot.
That's
enough to boot. Yeah, that should be enough to boot.
Certainly the Mate edition. So I thought, well, hang on.
I'm running out of a box over here. It's got 1 gig of memory.
Yeah, well, I've got to give it back soon. But my friend's old EPC, 701, which is the pre-Atom EPC with 512 of RAM in it, booted up the Mate edition, no problem. So I don't know what is going on there. Something, it must be doing some sort of check and it's failing that check. So I had to resort to Ubuntu Mate, and that runs pretty well. And within Ubuntu Mate, I installed Ubuntu -desktop, Zubuntu, and Lubuntu. They all work pretty well, except the touchpad doesn't work at all. So you just have to plug a mouse in. As I said, I think there are ways to get the touchpad working with kernel modules and modprobe.
Yeah, there's some sort of a hardware driver that Jeff has gone and found and put into Bodhi, I think.
Yeah, as far as I know, it's fairly straightforward to do with other distros. And the thing is that the Chromebook, you would think is fairly low-end hardware, but it really isn't, you know. That's the reason I bought this one. It is quite powerful, so it can handle Cinnamon, I would imagine. It can certainly handle Unity perfectly fine. The interface...
Well, yeah, because that installs just fine and runs beautifully as far as I can have heard. I haven't tried it, but
I tried the bare metal and it's fine. I don't like the interface. I've said that many times, but in terms of performance, it works perfectly well on this particular Chromebook.
So you think it's something in the Mint installer?
Yes, definitely.
Because I thought they were just using that Ubiquiti. It's nothing more than the Ubuntu installer, is it?
Well, it won't even boot, so I don't think it's necessarily the installer, but it's like the init scripts or something that is checking the RAM in the Chromebook must be reported as 0 or something to it, perhaps, or under 256, because there was a swap partition on it when I tried, so I can't explain it. But that, I think, is a discussion for another day. Something
wow, that's fascinating. Yeah.
Yeah. So do check that out, and maybe we can discuss it again in a couple of weeks. But one thing with Bodhi that I found very, very strange, given that it comes with almost no software and therefore it's a base from which to build your own distro effectively, you put the media player that you like on there, you put the file manager that you like on there. And so you can build it up to be customized how you want it to be, except I tried to install SingsCold, which requires a PPA, and you try and add a PPA, and it says add-apt-repository missing, not installed. And so there is out of the box no way to do that. And so I went hunting around, and I found a forum thread from a couple of weeks ago now, where someone had said, "What gives? How do I get this going?" And there's the first post from Jeff is PPAs are not recommended for use with Bodhi. And then in brackets, even Ubuntu recommended against using them for your information. They're unsupported software sources and make your system a nightmare to provide support for, since they can do whatever they want to your computer. The best method of getting the latest versions of software you want and need is to make a software request. So the command is left out on purpose. And then there's a bit of a back and forth in this thread. And then someone finally actually says, look, it's quite easy. You've just got to install python-software-properties and software properties comment. You do that, and then it works, no problem. So he has specifically excluded these two to stop people, by default at least, installing stuff from PPAs. And I find that a very strange decision. I can see where he's coming from with support, and you're going to get a lot of people flooding the forums. But this distro is not like a Linux Mint or an Ubuntu that comes with a full suite of everything that you want. This is for tinkerers who are going to want to do things like add PPA, surely, because that's how you customize it. As I say, SingsCold is a perfect example of that. This full screen launcher And the only way to get that going is with a PPA. So I really don't understand that decision.
Yeah, I know. The other thing that I installed on it, because I install this on every box that I get, is INXI.
Yeah.
And if you do sudo INXI-U.
Yeah.
To run the updater, it says, oh, all INXI self-updater features have been disabled by the distribution package maintainer.
That is an Ubuntu thing. All the Ubuntu and all its main flavors and, well, not derivatives, but flavors, Zubuntu, Ubuntu Mate, it's the same story. So that is coming from Canonical and Ubuntu, not from Bodhi in this case.
So I think Mint, you can update it though.
Yeah. So somehow Clem has
turned it off. Yeah, I don't know how that's annoying. I find that you can't do that.
Yeah.
But yeah, anyway.
So I mean, all in all then.
All in all, Bodhi Linux, what do you think? Keep it or shoot it?
I am not keeping it. That is for sure. I am not.
So not even on the Chromebook?
No, if I was going to not run Chrome OS on the Chromebook, and it's not something, as I said, that I'm going to do. It's not a machine I'm going to use all the time. It's another test box. So I'm sure there'll be lots of distros going on it and off it. But no, I wouldn't use that. I'd use something like Lubuntu or even Mint if I could get it running on it. I just wouldn't use this. I don't like Enlightenment enough is the bottom line. And it feels too buggy as well.
Yeah, I came into this discussion thinking, oh, I'm probably going to just run this on here. This is great. I got, you know, full-blown Linux on the Chromebook. I've been trying to do this for a while. Gets around some of the limitations of Chrome OS. I'll probably leave this thing on here. So I think I probably will for a bit. Maybe I'll get tired of Enlightenment. I don't know.
Well, one thing that I usually try and I haven't tried with this is to install a different desktop environment, log out, and see if you can run it.
Well, I was going to ask you if you thought that would actually work if I fired up and said, give me, say, XFCE on here.
Yeah.
And so that you download, I guess the problem is with XFCE, you end up with just that ugly stock XFCE nightmare.
Yeah, I would try Zubuntu-desktop. Apt-get install Zubuntu-desktop and see what...
Okay, and see what it actually installs. See, yeah.
If that meta package is available, then you'll get essentially Zubuntu on there, but it will download a whole load of stuff. Well, it's not actually that much. I installed, as I said, Zubuntu, Lubuntu, and Ubuntu, and all in all, it was about 970-odd megabytes. You know, it says that this much more disk space will be used. So it's got to be no more than a third of that, so only a few hundred megabytes to install Zubuntu.
So I'm going to do it as soon as we get off, just to try it out. And because I like XFCE, I already know that.
Yeah.
And so if that ticks along nicely, then yeah, well, sorry, Jeff. We might be running, I'll be running Bodhi with XFCE then.
Yeah,
I guess
you get the benefits of the touchpad working and the hardware support that they've put in, but you won't have to deal with Enlightenment, which is the whole point of Bodhi. But
yeah, that's right. It makes me kind of just feel dirty for doing it. I don't know. There's just something not right about that. I don't know what it is.
Yeah, and so the conclusion for me is it's worth checking out. And if you've got really, really old hardware, then it's fairly functional. It's not something, not like an open box where it's really not very functional. It's leaning towards a proper desktop experience, but it is also very light at the same time. So
it is very light, and I haven't really tossed anything at it that doesn't work yet, other than this Wi-Fi thing, which I think I can probably figure out with a little bit of effort.
Could be user error. Sounds like it to me, I must say.
Oh, I'm convinced. Every time I have Wi-Fi problems, that's what it is.
Yeah.
That there's something stupid thing that I haven't done right or don't know enough of. So,
yeah. So, I would say it's worth checking out, but it's not for me, I'm afraid.
Don't count on it, huh?
Yeah.
So you checked it out and liked the old stuff better.
Yeah.
That's the wrong show. Sorry. I was channeling my inner Patty there for a minute. Sorry, Patty.
All right. With that, then, let's do a bit of feedback.
So just one email that I found in here this week, in the last couple of weeks, actually, one from Michael Burton talking about our keyboard shortcuts. And is that where this? Yeah, I guess that's what this was about. Anyway, Michael says, I have a multimedia machine running Plex server that was configured with Linux Mint 13. When I updated to Linux Mint 17, the logon manager no longer had any keyboard shortcuts, just regular input asking for user and password. This is important to me because I run the machine headless 99% of the time. With Linux Mint 13, I could just enter a couple of keyboard shortcuts to power it down. Now I have to turn on the monitor, turn on the mouse, point, click to shut down, then turn off the mouse and the monitor. You tell me which is most convenient. So, Joe, I think you've got a kindred spirit there in Michael. He's liking your keyboard shortcuts, because I think this was a comment that I'd made that, well, you know, I just use the mouse. It's easier. I don't know about this keyboard shortcut stuff.
Well, the only response I can say is this guy, Michael Burton, seems to live in a parallel universe where SSH does not exist.
Does not exist.
If,
yeah,
you, just if you're really going to run it headless, then you'd better learn to do SSH, I think.
Yeah, actually, all the machines that I run headless. That's the only way I get at them. That or what's the No Machine is the other one that I use. It's X server thing. Yeah. So it works pretty well. So, or VPN. Yeah, VPN 5 is what Sergeant McBear suggests. Yep. Yeah. All those things are true. So I'll also point you to the comments thread. On the webpage, there have been a number of comments on the webpage about the last episode. And head on over to Google Plus, because there have been a couple of things over on the Google Plus comments as well. But we won't take the time to read them here, because you can go and read them there.
Yeah. So website of the week then is bodylinux.org, surprisingly. Yeah. We haven't got a tip or any announcements. Well, the announcement, I'm hoping that I will get this show out before the meetup in the pub, but no promises.
So when is the meetup in the pub?
Thursday, February the 26th, about 6 p.m., and it's the Mulberry Bush pub, which is on the South Bank near Waterloo Station. So we linked to it last time, but I'll stick a link in again, and there's detailed directions that Jesse wrote down to you come out of the train, you turn left, you follow this. It's very, very detailed.
Take 14 stops. Yeah. It's 14 steps. Turn left 12 degrees.
Yeah.
Yeah. Cool.
So some acknowledgements then. First of all, Kay Wisher for the Pycaster, a Raspberry Pi that streams each episode. We wouldn't have a live stream without it. And John Newsteader for the Mumble server that we use to communicate. And of course, thanks a lot to the Linux Mint development team for the fine distro that we love to talk about.
Outstanding. Well, we actually got a comment on the website, I think is where this was, about the last episode that was that snuck up over 2 hours in length, and that, oh, this was getting really hard to listen to. So I think this one's going to come in around an hour and a half, unless Joe takes off out all my rambling. So hopefully that's an improvement. Moving us in the right direction anyway.
People are looking at the thing going, why is it only 29 minutes now?
Yeah, what's this?
Took out all your rambling, yeah.
Yeah, right. Yeah, it's only 12 minutes. It's all the stuff that Joe said. Yeah, right.
Makes no sense at all. Right.
Right.
Any closing thoughts?
No, I think I've said far too much already. Thanks to the guys in the chat. Appreciated you guys being in there.
Yeah.
And, yep, worked out well. So we'll see you again in a couple of weeks, huh?
Yeah. See you in 2 weeks, guys. See you later.
This has been another episode of Mintcast. The show notes for this episode are at www.mintcast.org. You can send us email at mintcast@mintcast.org or leave voicemail at +1-832-514-2278. That's 832-514-CAST. You can find more information on Linux Mint at www.linuxmint.com. You can follow both Mintcast and Linux Mint on Twitter at Mintcast and at Linux_Mint. Thanks to Mark Blasco and Oscar for the podcast music, and thanks for listening to this episode of Midcast.